This is Audible.
King Leopold's Ghost by Adam Hochschild. Copyright 1998 by Adam Hochschild. This recording of the full-length reading of King Leopold's Ghost was published by arrangement with Georges Borchardt, Incorporated, and was produced in 2000 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Jeffrey Howard. For David Hunter. Introduction. The beginnings of this story lie far back in time, and its reverberations still sound today. But for me, a central incandescent moment, one that illuminates long decades before and after, is a young man's flash of moral recognition. The year is 1897 or 1898. Try to imagine him, briskly stepping off a cross-channel steamer, a forceful, burly man in his mid-twenties with a handlebar moustache. He is confident and well-spoken, but his British speech is without the polish of Eton or Oxford. He is well-dressed, but the clothes are not from Bond Street. With an ailing mother and a wife and growing family to support, he is not the sort of person likely to get caught up in an idealistic cause. His ideas are thoroughly conventional. He looks, and is, every inch the sober, respectable businessman. Edmund Dean Morell is a trusted employee of a Liverpool shipping line. A subsidiary of the company has the monopoly on all transport of cargo to and from the Congo Free State, as it is then called, the huge territory in Central Africa that is the world's only colony claimed by one man. That man is King Leopold II of Belgium, a ruler much admired throughout Europe as a philanthropic monarch. He has welcomed Christian missionaries to his new colony. His troops, it is said, have fought and defeated local slave traders who preyed on the population. And for more than a decade, European newspapers have praised him for investing his personal fortune in public works to benefit the Africans. Because Morel speaks fluent French, his company sends him to Belgium every few weeks to supervise the loading and unloading of ships on the Congo Run. Although the officials he works with have been handling this shipping traffic for years without a second thought, Morel begins to notice things that unsettle him. At the docks of the big port of Antwerp, he sees his company's ships arriving filled to the hatch covers with valuable cargoes of rubber and ivory. But when they cast off their hawsers to steam back to the Congo, while military bands play on the pier and eager young men in uniform line the ship's rails, what they carry is mostly army officers, firearms, and ammunition. There is no trade going on here. Little or nothing is being exchanged for the rubber and ivory. As Morel watches these riches streaming to Europe, with almost no goods being sent to Africa to pay for them, he realizes that there can be only one explanation for their source. Slave labor. Brought face to face with evil, Morel does not turn away. Instead, what he sees determines the course of his life and the course of an extraordinary movement, the first great international human rights movement of the 20th century. Seldom has one human being, impassioned, eloquent, blessed with brilliant organizing skills and nearly superhuman energy, managed almost single-handedly to put one subject on the world's front pages for more than a decade. Only a few years after standing on the docks of Antwerp, Edmund Morel would be at the White House, insisting to President Theodore Roosevelt that the United States had a special responsibility to do something about the Congo. He would organize delegations to the British Foreign Office. He would mobilize everyone from Booker T. Washington to Anatole France to the Archbishop of Canterbury to join his cause. More than 200 mass meetings to protest slave labor in the Congo would be held across the United States. A larger number of gatherings in England, nearly 300 a year at the Crusades' peak, would draw as many as 5,000 people at a time. In London, one letter of protest to the Times on the Congo would be signed by 11 peers, 19 bishops, 76 members of Parliament, the presidents of 7 chambers of commerce, 13 editors of major newspapers, and every Lord Mayor in the country. Speeches about the horrors of King Leopold's Congo would be given as far away as Australia. In Italy, two men would fight a duel over the issue. British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey, a man not given to overstatement, would declare that no external question for at least 30 years has moved the country so strongly and so vehemently. This is the story of that movement, of the savage crime that was its target, of the long period of exploration and conquest that preceded it, and of the way the world has forgotten one of the great mass killings of recent history. I knew almost nothing about the history of the Congo until a few years ago, when I noticed a footnote in a book I happened to be reading. Often, when you come across something particularly striking, you remember just where you were when you read it. On this occasion, I was sitting, stiff and tired, late at night, in one of the far rear seats of an airliner crossing the United States from east to west. The footnote was to a quotation by Mark Twain, written, the note said, when he was part of the worldwide movement against slave labor in the Congo, a practice that had taken 5 to 8 million lives. Worldwide movement? 5 to 8 million lives? I was startled. Statistics about mass murders are often hard to prove, but if this number turned out to be even half as high, I thought, the Congo would have been one of the major killing grounds of modern times. Why were these deaths not mentioned in the standard litany of our century's horrors? And why had I never before heard of them? I had been writing about human rights for years, and once, in the course of half a dozen trips to Africa, I had been to the Congo. That visit was in 1961. In a Leopoldville apartment, I heard a CIA man, who had had too much to drink, describe with satisfaction exactly how and where the newly independent country's first prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, had been killed a few months earlier. He assumed that any American, even a visiting student like me, would share his relief at the assassination of a man the United States government considered a dangerous leftist troublemaker. In the early morning, a day or two later, I left the country by ferry across the Congo River, the conversation still ringing in my head as the sun rose over the waves and the dark, smooth water slapped against the boat's hull. It was several decades later that I encountered that footnote, and with it my own ignorance of the Congo's early history. Then it occurred to me that, like millions of other people, I had read something about that time and place after all. Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. However, with my college lecture notes on the novel filled with scribbles about Freudian overtones, mythic echoes, and inward vision, I had mentally filed away the book under fiction, not fact. I began to read more. The further I explored, the more it was clear that the Congo of a century ago had indeed seen a death toll of Holocaust dimensions. At the same time, I unexpectedly found myself absorbed by the extraordinary characters who had peopled this patch of history. Although it was Edmund Dean Morel who had ignited a movement, he was not the first outsider to see King Leopold's Congo for what it was and to try hard to draw the world's attention to it. That role was played by George Washington Williams, a black American journalist and historian who, unlike anyone before him, interviewed Africans about their experience of their white conquerors. It was another black American, William Shepard, who recorded a scene he came across in the Congo rainforest that would brand itself on the world's consciousness as a symbol of colonial brutality. There were other heroes as well, one of the bravest of whom ended his life on a London gallows. Then, of course, into the middle of the story sailed the young sea captain, Joseph Conrad, expecting the exotic Africa of his childhood dreams, but finding instead what he would call the vilest scramble for loot that ever disfigured the history of human conscience. And looming above them all was King Leopold II, a man as filled with greed and cunning, duplicity and charm as any of the more complex villains of Shakespeare. As I followed the intersecting lives of these men, I realized something else about the terror in the Congo and the controversy that came to surround it. It was the first major international atrocity scandal in the age of the telegraph and the camera. In its mixture of bloodshed on an industrial scale, royalty, sex, the power of celebrity, and rival lobbying and media campaigns raging in half a dozen countries on both sides of the Atlantic, it seemed strikingly close to our time. Furthermore, unlike many other great predators of history, from Genghis Khan to the Spanish conquistadors, King Leopold II never saw a drop of blood spilled in anger. He never set foot in the Congo. There is something very modern about that, too, as there is about the bomber pilot in the stratosphere, above the clouds, who never hears screams or sees shattered homes or torn flesh. Although Europe has long forgotten the victims of Leopold's Congo, I found a vast supply of raw material to work with in reconstructing their fate. Congo memoirs by explorers, steamboat captains, military men, the records of mission stations, reports of government investigations, and those peculiarly Victorian phenomena accounts by gentlemen, or sometimes lady, travellers. The Victorian era was a golden age of letters and diaries, and it often seems as if every visitor or official in the Congo kept a voluminous journal and spent each evening on the riverbank writing letters home. One problem, of course, is that nearly all of this vast river of words is by Europeans or Americans. There was no written language in the Congo when Europeans first arrived, and this inevitably skewed the way that history was recorded. We have dozens of memoirs by the territory's white officials. We know the changing opinions of key people in the British Foreign Office, sometimes on a day-by-day basis. But we do not have a full-length memoir or complete oral history of a single Congolese during the period of the greatest terror. Instead of African voices from this time, there is largely silence. And yet, as I immersed myself in this material, I saw how revealing it was. The men who seized the Congo often trumpeted their killings, bragging about them in books and newspaper articles. Some kept surprisingly frank diaries that show far more than the writers intended, as does a voluminous and explicit instruction book for colonial officials. Furthermore, several officers of the private army that occupied the Congo came to feel guilty about the blood on their hands. Their testimony and the documents they smuggled out helped to fuel the protest movement. Even on the part of the brutally suppressed Africans, the silence is not complete. Some of their actions and voices, though filtered through the records of their conquerors, we can still see and hear. The worst of the bloodshed in the Congo took place between 1890 and 1910, but its origins lie much earlier, when Europeans and Africans first encountered each other there. And so, to reach the headwaters of our story, we must leap back more than 500 years, to a time when a ship's captain saw the ocean change its colour, and when a king received news of a strange apparition that had risen from inside the earth. Prologue. The traders are killing our people. When Europeans began imagining Africa beyond the Sahara, the continent they pictured was a dreamscape, a site for fantasies of the fearsome and the supernatural. Ranulf Higden, a Benedictine monk who mapped the world about 1350, claimed that Africa contained one-eyed people who used their feet to cover their heads. A geographer in the next century announced that the continent held people with one leg, three faces, and the heads of lions. In 1459, an Italian monk, Fra Mauro, declared Africa the home of the roc, a bird so large that it could carry an elephant through the air. In the Middle Ages, almost no one in Europe was in a position to know whether Africa contained giant birds, one-eyed people, or anything else. Hostile Moors lived on Africa's Mediterranean coast, and few Europeans dared set foot there, much less head south across the Sahara. And as for trying to sail down the West African coast, everyone knew that as soon as you passed the Canary Islands, you would be in the Mare Tenebroso, the Sea of Darkness. In the medieval imagination, writes Peter Forbath, this was a region of uttermost dread, where the heavens fling down liquid sheets of flame and the waters boil, where serpent rocks and ogre islands lie in wait for the mariner, where the giant hand of Satan reaches up from the fathomless depths to seize him, where he will turn black in face and body as a mark of God's vengeance for the insolence of his prying into this forbidden mystery. And even if he should be able to survive all these ghastly perils and sail on through, he would then arrive in the sea of obscurity and be lost forever in the vapours and slime at the edge of the world. It was not until the 15th century, the dawn of the age of ocean navigation, that Europeans systematically began to venture south, the Portuguese in the lead. In the 1440s, Lisbon's shipbuilders developed the caravel, a compact vessel particularly good at sailing into the wind. Although rarely more than 100 feet long, this sturdy ship carried explorers far down the west coast of Africa, where no one knew what gold, spices, and precious stones might lie. But it was not only lust for riches that drove the explorers. Somewhere in Africa, they knew, was the source of the Nile, a mystery that had fascinated Europeans since antiquity. They were also driven by one of the most enduring of medieval myths, the legend of Prester John, a Christian king who was said to rule a vast empire in the interior of Africa, where, from a palace of translucent crystal and precious stones, he reigned over 42 lesser kings, in addition to assorted centaurs and giants. No traveller was ever turned away from his dinner table of solid emerald, which seated thousands. Surely Prester John would be eager to share his riches with his fellow Christians and to help them find their way onward to the fabled wealth of India. Successive Portuguese expeditions probed ever farther southward. In 1482, an experienced naval captain named Diogo Cao set off on the most ambitious voyage yet. As he sailed close to the West African coast, he saw the North Star disappear from the sky once his caravel crossed the equator, and he found himself much farther south than anyone from Europe had ever been. One day, Cao came upon something that astounded him. Around his ship, the sea turned a dark, slate-tinged yellow, and brownish-yellow waves were breaking on the nearby beaches. Sailing toward the mouth of an inlet many miles wide, his caravel had to fight a current of 8 to 9 knots. Furthermore, a taste of the water surrounding the ship revealed that it was fresh, not salt. Cao had stumbled on the mouth of an enormous silt-filled river, larger than any a European had ever seen. The impression its vastness made on him and his men is reflected in a contemporary account. For the space of 20 leagues, the river preserves its fresh water unbroken by the briny billows which encompass it on every side, as if this noble river had determined to try its strength in pitched battle with the ocean itself, and alone deny it the tribute which all other rivers in the world pay without resistance. Modern oceanographers have discovered more evidence of the great river's strength in its pitched battle with the ocean. 100-mile-long canyon in places 4,000 feet deep that the river has carved out of the sea floor. Cao went ashore at the river's mouth and erected a limestone pillar topped with an iron cross and inscribed with the royal coat of arms and the words, "In the year 6681 of the world, and in that of 1482 since the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ, the most serene, the most excellent and potent prince, King João II of Portugal, did order this land to be discovered, and this pillar of stone to be erected by Diogo Cao, an esquire in his household." The river where he had landed would be known by Europeans for most of the next 500 years as the Congo. It flowed into the sea at the northern end of a thriving African kingdom, an imperial federation of 2 to 3 million people. Ever since then, geographers have usually spelled the name of the river and the eventual European colony on its banks one way, and that of the people living around its mouth and their indigenous kingdom another. The kingdom of the Congo was roughly 300 miles square, comprising territory that today lies in several countries. Its capital was the town of Mbanza, Congo. Mbanza means court, on a commanding hilltop some 10 days walk inland from the coast, and today just on the Angolan side of the Angola-Congo border. In 1491, 9 years and several voyages after Diogo Cao's landfall, an expedition of awed Portuguese priests and emissaries made this 10-day trek and set up housekeeping as permanent representatives of their country in the court of the Congo king. Their arrival marked the beginning of the first sustained encounter between Europeans and a black African nation. The Kingdom of the Congo had been in place for at least 100 years before the Portuguese arrived. Its monarch, the Manicongo, was chosen by an assembly of clan leaders. Like his European counterparts, he sat on a throne, in his case made of wood inlaid with ivory. As symbols of royal authority, the Manicongo carried a zebra-tail whip, had the skins and heads of baby animals suspended from his belt, and wore a small cap. In the capital, the king dispensed justice, received homage, and reviewed his troops under a fig tree in the large public square. Whoever approached him had to do so on all fours. On pain of death, no one was allowed to watch him eat or drink. Before he did either, an attendant struck 2 iron poles together, and anyone in sight had to lie face down on the ground. The Manicongo, who was then on the throne, greeted the Portuguese warmly. His enthusiasm was probably due less to the savior his unexpected guests told him about than to the help their magical fire-spouting weapons promised in suppressing a troublesome provincial rebellion. The Portuguese were glad to oblige. The newcomers built churches and mission schools. Like many white evangelists who followed them, they were horrified by polygamy. They thought it was the spices in the African food that provoked the dreadful practice. But despite their contempt for Congo culture, the Portuguese grudgingly recognized in the kingdom a sophisticated and well-developed state, the leading one on the west coast of Central Africa. The Manicongo appointed governors for each of some 6 provinces, and his rule was carried out by an elaborate civil service that included such specialized positions as Mani Vangu Vangu, or first judge in cases of adultery. Although they were without writing or the wheel, the inhabitants forged copper into jewellery and iron into weapons, and wove clothing out of fibres stripped from the leaves of the raffia palm tree. According to myth, the founder of the Congo state was a blacksmith king, so ironwork was an occupation of the nobility. People cultivated yams, bananas, and other fruits and vegetables, and raised pigs, cattle, and goats. They measured distance by marching days and marked time by the lunar month and by a four-day week, the first day of which was a holiday. The king collected taxes from his subjects and, like many a ruler, controlled the currency supply. Cowrie shells found on a coastal island under royal authority. As in much of Africa, the kingdom had slavery. The nature of African slavery varied from one area to another and changed over time, but most slaves were people captured in warfare. Others had been criminals or debtors, or were given away by their families as part of a dowry settlement. Like any system that gives some human beings total power over others, slavery in Africa could be vicious. Some Congo Basin people sacrificed slaves on special occasions, such as the ratification of a treaty between chiefdoms. The slow death of an abandoned slave, his bones broken, symbolized the fate of anyone who violated the treaty. Some slaves might also be sacrificed to give a dead chief's soul some company on its journey into the next world. In other ways, African slavery was more flexible and benign than the system Europeans would soon establish in the New World. Over a generation or two, slaves could often earn or be granted their freedom, and free people and slaves sometimes intermarried. Nonetheless, the fact that trading in human beings existed in any form turned out to be catastrophic for Africa. For when Europeans showed up ready to buy endless shiploads of slaves, they found African chiefs willing to sell. Soon enough, the slave buyers came. They arrived in small numbers at first, but then in a flood unleashed by events across the Atlantic. In 1500, only 9 years after the first Europeans arrived at Mbanza, Congo, a Portuguese expedition was blown off course and came upon Brazil. Within a few decades, the Western Hemisphere became a huge, lucrative, nearly insatiable market for African slaves. They were put to work by the millions in Brazil's mines and on its coffee plantations, as well as on the Caribbean islands, where other European powers quickly began using the lush, fertile land to grow sugar. In the Kingdom of the Congo, the Portuguese forgot the search for Prester John. Slaving fever seized them. Men sent out from Lisbon to be masons or teachers at Mbanza, Congo, soon made far more money by herding convoys of chained Africans to the coast and selling them to the captains of slave-carrying caravels. The lust for slave profits engulfed even some of the priests, who abandoned their preaching, took black women as concubines, kept slaves themselves, and sold their students and converts into slavery. The priests who strayed from the fold stuck to their faith in one way, however. After the Reformation, they tried to ensure that none of their human goods ended up in Protestant hands. It was surely not right, said one, for persons baptized in the Catholic Church to be sold to peoples who are enemies of their faith. A village near Diogo Cao's stone pillar on the south shore of the Congo River estuary became a slave port, from which more than 5,000 slaves a year were being shipped across the Atlantic by the 1530s. By the next century, 15,000 slaves a year were exported from the Kingdom of the Congo as a whole. Traders kept careful records of their booty. One surviving inventory from this region lists 68 head of slaves by name, physical defects, and cash value, starting with the men, who were worth the most money, and ending with child, name unknown as she is dying and cannot speak, male without value, and a small girl, Kalenbo, no value because she is dying, one small girl, Kantumbi, no value because she is dying. Many of the slaves shipped to the Americas from the Great River's mouth came from the Kingdom of the Congo itself. Many others were captured by African slave dealers who ranged more than 700 miles into the interior, buying slaves from local chiefs and headmen. Force marched to the coast, their necks locked into wooden yokes, the slaves were rarely given enough food. And because caravans usually travelled in the dry season, they often drank stagnant water. The trails to the slave ports were soon strewn with bleaching bones. Once they were properly baptised, clothed in leftover burlap cargo wrappings, and chained together in ships' holds, most slaves from this region were sent to Brazil, the nearest part of the New World. Starting in the 1600s, however, a growing demand tempted many ship captains to make the longer voyage to the British colonies in North America. Roughly one of every four slaves imported to work the cotton and tobacco plantations of the American South began his or her journey across the Atlantic from equatorial Africa, including the Congo Kingdom. The Kikongo language, spoken around the Congo River's mouth, is one of the African tongues whose traces linguists have found in the Gullah dialect spoken by black Americans today on the coastal islands of South Carolina and Georgia. When the Atlantic slave trade began decimating the Congo, that nation was under the reign of a Manikongo named Nzinga Mbemba Afonso, who had gained the throne in 1506 and ruled as Afonso I for nearly 40 years. Afonso's life spanned a crucial period. When he was born, no one in the kingdom knew that Europeans existed. When he died, his entire realm was threatened by the slave-selling fever they had caused. He was a man of tragic self-awareness, and he left his mark. Some 300 years later, a missionary said, "A native of the Congo knows the name of three kings, that of the present one, that of his predecessor, and that of Afonso." He was a provincial chief in his early 30s when the Portuguese first arrived at Mbanza, Congo, in 1491. A convert to Christianity, he took on the name Afonso and some Portuguese advisers and studied for 10 years with the priests at Mbanza, Congo. One wrote to the King of Portugal that Afonso knows better than us the prophets, the gospel of our Saviour Jesus Christ, all the lives of the saints, and all that has to do with our Holy Mother Church. If your Highness saw him, you would be astonished. He speaks so well and with such assurance that it always seems to me that the Holy Spirit speaks through his mouth. My Lord, he does nothing but study. Many times he falls asleep over his books, and many times he forgets to eat or drink because he is speaking of our Saviour. It is hard to tell how much of this glowing portrait was inspired by the priest's attempt to impress the Portuguese king, and how much by Afonso's attempt to impress the priest. In the language of a later age, King Afonso I was a moderniser. He urgently tried to acquire European learning, weapons, and goods in order to strengthen his rule and fortify it against the destabilizing force of the white arrival. Having noticed the Portuguese appetite for copper, for example, he traded it for European products that would help him buy the submission of outlying provinces. Clearly a man of unusual intelligence, Afonso tried to do something as difficult in his time as in ours, to be a selective moderniser. He was an enthusiast for the church, for the written word, for European medicine, and for woodworking, masonry, and other skills to be learned from Portuguese craftsmen. But when his fellow king in Lisbon sent an envoy to urge the adoption of Portugal's legal code and court protocol, Afonso wasn't interested. And he tried hard to keep out prospectors, fearing total takeover of his land if Europeans found the gold and silver they coveted. Because virtually everything we know about this part of Africa for the next several hundred years comes to us from its white conquerors, King Afonso I provides something rare and valuable, an African voice. Indeed, his is one of the very few Central African voices that we can hear at all before the 20th century. He used his fluency in Portuguese to dictate a remarkable series of letters to two successive Portuguese kings, the first known documents composed by a black African in any European language. Several dozen of the letters survive above his signature with its regal flourish of double underlinings. Their tone is the formal one of monarch to monarch, usually beginning, "Most high and powerful prince and king, my brother." But we can hear not just a king speaking. We hear a human being, one who is aghast to see his people taken away in ever greater numbers on slave ships. Afonso was no abolitionist. Like most African rulers of his time and later, he owned slaves, and at least once he sent some as a present to his brother king in Lisbon, along with leopard skins, parrots, and copper anklets. But this traditional exchange of gifts among kings seemed greatly different to Afonso from having tens of thousands of his previously free subjects taken across the sea in chains. Listen to him as he writes King João III of Portugal in 1526. "Each day the traders are kidnapping our people, children of this country, sons of our nobles and vassals, even people of our own family. This corruption and depravity are so widespread that our land is entirely depopulated. We need in this kingdom only priests and schoolteachers, and no merchandise, unless it is wine and flour for mass. It is our wish that this kingdom not be a place for the trade or transport of slaves." Later the same year, "Many of our subjects eagerly lust after Portuguese merchandise that your subjects have brought into our domains. To satisfy this inordinate appetite, they seize many of our black free subjects. They sell them, after having taken these prisoners to the coast, secretly or at night. As soon as the captives are in the hands of white men, they are branded with a red-hot iron. Again and again, Afonso speaks about the twin themes of the slave trade and the alluring array of cloth, tools, jewelry, and other knick-knacks that the Portuguese traders used to buy their human cargoes. These goods exert such a great attraction over simple and ignorant people that they believe in them and forget their belief in God. My lord, a monstrous greed pushes our subjects, even Christians, to seize members of their own families and of ours to do business by selling them as captives. While begging the Portuguese king to send him teachers, pharmacists, and doctors instead of traders, Afonso admits that the flood of material goods threatened his authority. His people can now procure in much greater quantity than we can the things we formerly used to keep them obedient to us and content. Afonso's lament was prescient. This was not the last time that lust for Europe's great cornucopia of goods undermined traditional ways of life elsewhere. The Portuguese kings showed no sympathy. King João III replied, "You tell me that you want no slave trading in your domains because this trade is depopulating your country. The Portuguese there, on the contrary, tell me how vast the Congo is and how it is so thickly populated that it seems as if no slave has ever left." Afonso pleaded with his fellow sovereigns as one Christian with another, complete with the prejudices of the day. Of the priests turned slave traders, he wrote, "In this kingdom, faith is as fragile as glass because of the bad examples of the men who come to teach here, because the lusts of the world and lure of wealth have turned them away from the truth. Just as the Jews crucified the Son of God because of covetousness, my brother, so today he is again crucified." Several times Afonso sent his appeals for an end to the slave trade directly to the Pope in Rome, but the Portuguese detained his emissaries to the Vatican as they stepped off the boat in Lisbon. Afonso's despair reached its depth in 1539, near the end of his life, when he heard that 10 of his young nephews, grandsons, and other relatives who had been sent to Portugal for a religious education had disappeared en route. "We don't know whether they are dead or alive," he wrote in desperation, "nor how they might have died, nor what news we can give of them to their fathers and mothers." We can imagine the king's horror at being unable to guarantee the safety even of his own family. Portuguese traders and sea captains along the long route back to Europe sidetracked many a cargo between the Congo Kingdom and Lisbon. These youngsters, it turned out, ended up in Brazil as slaves. His hatred for the overseas slave trade and his vigilance against its erosion of his authority won Afonso the enmity of some of the Portuguese merchants living in his capital. A group of 8 made an attempt on his life as he was attending Mass on Easter Sunday in 1540. He escaped with only a bullet hole in the fringe of his royal robe, but one of his nobles was killed and 2 others wounded. After Afonso's death, the power of the Congo state gradually diminished, as provincial and village chiefs, themselves growing rich on slave sales, no longer gave much allegiance to the court at Mbanza, Congo. By the end of the 1500s, other European countries had joined in the slave trade. British, French, and Dutch vessels roamed the African coast, looking for human cargo. In 1665, the army of the weakened Kingdom of the Congo fought a battle with the Portuguese. It was defeated, and the Manicongo was beheaded. Internal strife further depleted the kingdom, whose territory was all taken over by European colonies in the late 1800s. Except for Afonso's letters, the written record of these times still shows them entirely through white men's eyes. How did the Europeans, beginning with Diogo Cao and his 3 ships with faded red crosses on their sails, appear to the people living at the great river's mouth? To see with their eyes, we must turn to the myths and legends that have filtered down over the centuries. At first, Africans apparently saw the white sailors not as men, but as vumbi, ancestral ghosts, since the Congo people believed that a person's skin changed to the color of chalk when he passed into the land of the dead. And it was obvious that this was where these menacing white vumbi had come from, for people on the shore saw first the tips of an approaching ship's masts, then its superstructure, then its hull. Clearly the ship had carried its passengers up from their homes beneath the surface of the earth. Here is how the Portuguese arrival was recounted by Mukunzo Kioko, a 20th century oral historian of the Pende people. "Our fathers were living comfortably. They had cattle and crops. They had salt marshes and banana trees. Suddenly they saw a big boat rising out of the great ocean. This boat had wings, all of white, sparkling like knives. White men came out of the water and spoke words which no one understood. Our ancestors took fright. They said that these were Vumbi, spirits returned from the dead. They pushed them back into the ocean with volleys of arrows. But the Vumbi spat fire with a noise of thunder. Many men were killed. Our ancestors fled. The chiefs and wise men said that these Vumbi were the former possessors of the land. From that time to our days now, the whites have brought us nothing but wars and miseries. The transatlantic slave trade seemed further confirmation that Europeans had come from the land of the dead, for after they took their shiploads of slaves out to sea, the captives never returned. Just as Europeans would be long obsessed with African cannibalism, so Africans imagined Europeans practicing the same thing. The whites were thought to turn their captives' flesh into salt meat, their brains into cheese, and their blood into the red wine Europeans drank. African bones were burned, and the grey ash became gunpowder. The huge smoking copper cooking kettles that could be seen on sailing vessels were, it was believed, where all these deadly transformations began. The death tolls on the packed slave ships that sailed west from the Congo coast rose higher still when some slaves refused to eat the food they were given, believing that they would be eating those who had sailed before them. As the years passed, new myths arose to explain the mysterious objects the strangers brought from the land of the dead. A 19th-century missionary recorded, for example, an African explanation of what happened when captains descended into the holds of their ships to fetch trading goods like cloth. The Africans believed that these goods came not from the ship itself, but from a hole that led into the ocean. Sea sprites weave this cloth in an oceanic factory, and, whenever we need cloth, the captain goes to this hole and rings a bell. The sea sprites hand him up their cloth, and the captain then throws in, as payment, a few dead bodies of black people he has bought from those bad native traders who have bewitched their people and sold them to the white men. The myth was not so far from reality, for what was slavery in the American South, after all, but a system for transforming the labor of black bodies via cotton plantations into cloth? Because African middlemen brought captives directly to their ships, Portuguese traders seldom ventured far from the coast. For nearly four centuries, in fact, after Diogo Cao came upon the Congo River, Europeans did not know where the river came from. It pours some 1.4 million cubic feet of water per second into the ocean. Only the Amazon carries more water. Besides its enormous size and unknown course, the Congo posed another puzzle. Seamen noticed that its flow, compared with that of other tropical rivers, fluctuated relatively little during the year. Rivers such as the Amazon and the Ganges had phases of extremely high water and low water, depending on whether the land they drained was experiencing the rainy or the dry season. What made the Congo different? The reason several centuries' worth of visitors failed to explore the Congo's source was that they couldn't sail upstream. Anyone who tried found that the river turned into a gorge, at the head of which were impassable rapids. Much of the Congo River Basin, we now know, lies on a plateau in the African interior. From the western rim of this plateau, nearly 1,000 feet high, the river descends to sea level in a mere 220 miles. During this tumultuous descent, the river squeezes through narrow canyons, boils up in waves 40 feet high, and tumbles over 32 separate cataracts. So great is the drop and the volume of water that these 220 miles have as much hydroelectric potential as all the lakes and rivers of the United States combined. For any sailor bold enough to get out of his ship and walk, the land route around the rapids wound uphill through rough, rocky country, feared for its treacherous cliffs and ravines, and for malaria and the other diseases to which Europeans had no immunity. Only with enormous difficulty did some Capuchin missionaries twice manage to get briefly inland as far as the top of the Great Rapids. A Portuguese expedition that tried to repeat this trek never returned. By the beginning of the 19th century, Europeans still knew nothing about the interior of Central Africa, or about where the river began. In 1816, a British expedition led by Captain James K. Tuckey of the Royal Navy set off to find the Congo's origins. His two ships carried a wonderfully odd assortment of people: Royal Marines, carpenters, blacksmiths, a surgeon, a gardener from the Royal Gardens at Kew, a botanist, and an anatomist. The anatomist was directed, among other things, to make a careful study of the hippopotamus and to preserve in spirits and, if possible, in triplicate, the organ of hearing of this animal. A Mr. Cranch was entered on the ship's log as collector of objects of natural history. Another expedition member was simply listed as volunteer and observant gentleman. When he arrived at the Congo's mouth, Tucky counted 8 slave ships from various nations at anchor, awaiting their cargoes. He sailed his own ships as far up the river as he could, and then set off to skirt the thunderous rapids overland. But he and his exhausted men grew discouraged by endless scrambling up the sides of almost perpendicular hills and over great masses of quartz. These came to be called the Crystal Mountains. The river was a mass of foaming rapids and enormous whirlpools. At a rare, calm stretch, Tucky observed, rather provincially, that the scenery was beautiful and not inferior to any on the banks of the Thames. One by one, the Englishmen began to suffer from an unknown illness, most likely yellow fever, and after about 150 miles, Tucky lost heart. His party turned around, and he died shortly after getting back to his ship. By the time the shaken survivors of the expedition made their way back to England, 21 of the 54 men who had set out were dead. The source of the Congo River and the secret of its steady flow was still a mystery. For Europeans, Africa remained the supplier of valuable raw materials, human bodies and elephant tusks. But otherwise, they saw the continent as faceless, blank, empty, a place on the map waiting to be explored. One ever more frequently described by the phrase that says more about the seer than the seen. The Dark Continent. 1. Walking into Fire. Chapter 1. I Shall Not Give Up the Chase. On January 28, 1841, a quarter century after Tucky's failed expedition, the man who would spectacularly accomplish what Tucky tried to do was born in the small Welsh market town of Denbigh. He was entered on the birth register of St. Hilary's Church as John Rowlands, Bastard, an epithet that was to mark the boy for the rest of his life, a life obsessively devoted to living down a sense of shame. Young John was the first of 5 illegitimate children born to Betsy Parry, a housemaid. His father may have been John Rowlands, a local drunkard who died of delirium tremens, or a prominent and married lawyer named James Vaughan Horne, or a boyfriend of Betsy Parry's in London, where she had been working. After giving birth, Betsy Parry departed from Denbigh in disgrace, leaving her baby behind in the home of his 2 uncles and his maternal grandfather, a man who believed a boy needed a sound whipping if he misbehaved. When John was 5, his grandfather died, and the uncles immediately got rid of their unwanted nephew by paying a local family 0.5 crown a week to take him in. When the family asked for more money, the uncles refused. One day, the foster family told young John that their son Dick would take him to visit his Aunt Mary in another village. The way seemed interminable and tedious. At last, Dick set me down from his shoulders before an immense stone building, and, passing through tall iron gates, he pulled at a bell, which I could hear clanging noisily in the distant interior. A somber-faced stranger appeared at the door who, despite my remonstrances, seized me by the hand and drew me within, while Dick tried to soothe my fears with glib promises that he was only going to bring Aunt Mary to me. The door closed on him, and with the echoing sound, I experienced for the first time the awful feeling of utter desolateness. 6-year-old John Rowlands was now an inmate of the St. Asaph Union Workhouse. Records of life at St. Asaph's are generally covered by a veil of Victorian euphemism, but a local newspaper complained that the master of the workhouse was an alcoholic who took indecent liberties with women on his staff. An investigative commission that visited the workhouse in 1847, about the time John Rowlands arrived, reported that male adults took part in every possible vice, and that children slept 2 to a bed, an older child with a younger, resulting in their starting to practice and understand things they should not. For the rest of his life, John Rowlands would show a fear of sexual intimacy in any form. Whatever John may have endured or seen in the workhouse dormitory, in its schoolroom he thrived. For his achievements he won a prize Bible from the local bishop. He was fascinated by geography. He had an unusual ability to mimic someone else's handwriting after studying it for a few minutes. His own penmanship was strikingly graceful. His youthful signature was stylish and forward-leaning, with the stems and tails of the letters sweeping dramatically far above and below the line. It was as if, through his handwriting, he were trying to pull himself out of disgrace and turn the script of his life from one of poverty to one of elegance. One evening, when John was 12, his supervisor came up to me during the dinner hour when all the inmates were assembled, and, pointing out a tall woman with an oval face and a great coil of dark hair behind her head, asked me if I recognized her. "No, sir," I replied. "What? You do not know your own mother?" I started with a burning face and directed a shy glance at her, and perceived she was regarding me with a look of cool, critical scrutiny. I had expected to feel a gush of tenderness towards her, but her expression was so chilling that the valves of my heart closed as with a snap. Adding to his shock was the fact that his mother had brought two new illegitimate children to St. Asaph's with her, a boy and a girl. Some weeks later she left the workhouse. For John, it was the latest in a chain of abandonments. At 15, John left St. Asaph's and stayed with a succession of relatives, all of whom seemed queasy about sheltering a poorhouse cousin. At 17, while he was living with an uncle in Liverpool and working as a butcher's delivery boy, he feared he was about to be turned out once more. One day, he delivered some meat to an American merchant ship at the docks, the Windermere. The captain eyed this short but sturdy-looking young man and asked, "How would you like to sail in this ship?" In February 1859, after a 7-week voyage, the Windermere landed in New Orleans, where the young newcomer jumped ship. He long remembered the city's fascinating array of smells: tar, brine, green coffee, rum, and molasses. Roaming the streets in search of work, on the porch of a warehouse he spied a middle-aged man in a stovepipe hat, a cotton broker, as it turned out, and approached him. "Do you want a boy, sir?" The cotton broker, impressed by John's only reference, the prized Bible with the bishop's inscription, took on the Welsh teenager as an employee. Soon after, young John Rowlands, now living in the New World, decided to give himself a new name. The procedure was gradual. In the 1860 New Orleans census, he is listed as J. Rolling. A woman who knew him at this time remembered him as John Rollins, smart as a whip and much given to bragging, big talk, and telling stories. Within a few years, however, he began using the first and last name of the merchant who had given him his job. He continued to experiment with the middle names, using Morley, Morlake, and Morland, before finally settling on Morton. And so the boy who had entered the St. Asaph Union Workhouse as John Rowlands became the man who would soon be known worldwide as Henry Morton Stanley. Stanley gave himself not only a new name, he tried for the rest of his life to give himself a new biography. The man who would become the most famous explorer of his time, renowned for his accurate observations of African wildlife and terrain, was a world-class obfuscator when it came to his early life. In his autobiography, for example, he tells of leaving the Welsh workhouse in melodramatic terms. "He leaped over a garden wall and escaped," he claims, "after leading a class rebellion against a cruel supervisor named James Francis, who had viciously brutalized the entire senior class. 'Never again,' I shouted, marvelling at my own audacity. The words had scarcely escaped me ere I found myself swung upwards into the air by the collar of my jacket and flung into a nerveless heap on the bench. Then the passionate brute pummeled me in the stomach until I fell backward, gasping for breath. Again I was lifted and dashed on the bench with a shock that almost broke my spine." Stanley was then a vigorous, healthy 15-year-old, and would not have been an easy victim for Francis, a former coal miner who had lost one hand in a mining accident. Other students later recalled no mutiny, much less one led by Stanley. They remembered Francis as a gentleman, and Stanley as a teacher's pet, often given favours and encouragement, and put in charge of the class when Francis was away. Workhouse records show Stanley leaving not as a runaway, but to live at his uncle's while going to school. Equally fanciful is Stanley's account of his time in New Orleans. He lived, he says, at the home of the benevolent cotton broker, Henry Stanley, and his saintly, fragile wife. When a yellow fever epidemic struck the city, she sickened and died, in a bed curtained with white muslin, but at the moment of death she opened her mild eyes and spoke words as from afar, "Be a good boy. God bless you." Soon after, her sorrowing widower clasped his young tenant and employee to his breast and declared that, "In future, you are to bear my name." What followed, Stanley claims, were two idyllic years of travelling on business with the man he refers to as my father. They took riverboats up and down the Mississippi, walking the decks together, reading aloud to each other, and talking about the Bible. But sadly, in 1861, Stanley's generous adoptive father followed his beloved wife into the next world. For the first time, I understood the sharpness of the pang which pierces the soul when a loved one lies with folded hands, icy cold in the eternal sleep. As I contemplated the body, I vexed myself with asking, had my conduct been as perfect as I then wished it had been? Had I failed in aught? Had I esteemed him as he deserved? A poignant story, except that the records show that both the elder Stanleys did not die until 1878, 17 years later. Although they did adopt two children, both were girls. According to city directories and census reports, young Stanley lived not in their home, but in a series of boarding houses. And Stanley the merchant had an angry quarrel and permanent rupture with his employee, after which he asked that the young man's name never again be mentioned in his presence. Stanley's wishful description of his youth clearly owes something to his contemporary Charles Dickens, similarly fond of deathbed scenes, saintly women, and wealthy benefactors. It also owes much to Stanley's feeling that his real life was so embedded in disgrace that he would have to invent whatever self he presented to the world. Not only did he make up events in his autobiography, but he created journal entries about a dramatic shipwreck and other adventures that never happened. Sometimes an episode in his African travels appears in strikingly different form in his journal, in letters, in the newspaper articles he sent home, and in the books he wrote after each trip. Psychohistorians have had a feast. One of the more revealing episodes Stanley describes or invents took place soon after he arrived in New Orleans, when he was sharing a bed in a boarding house with Dick Heaton, another young man who had come over from Liverpool as a deckhand. He was so modest he would not retire by candlelight, and, when he got into bed, he lay on the verge of it, far removed from contact with me. When I rose in the morning, I found that he was not undressed. One day, Stanley awoke and, looking at Dick Heaton asleep at his side, was amazed to see what I took to be two tumours on his breast. I sat up and cried out, I know, Dick, you are a girl." That evening, Dick, who by then had confessed to being Alice, was gone. She was never seen or heard of by me again, but I have hoped ever since that fate was as propitious to her as I think it was wise, in separating two young and simple creatures who might have been led, through excess of sentiment, into folly. Like his Dickensian deathbed scene, this has an echo of legend, of the girl who disguises herself as a boy so that she can enlist as a soldier or run away to sea. Whether real or made up, the episode's emotional message is the same. Stanley's horror at the idea of finding himself so close to a woman. When the American Civil War began, Stanley joined the Confederate Army, and in April 1862 went into combat with his regiment of Arkansas Volunteers at the Battle of Shiloh in Tennessee. On the second day of fighting, he was surrounded by half a dozen Union soldiers, and soon afterward found himself in a crowded, typhus-ridden prisoner of war camp outside Chicago. The only way out of this miserable place, he discovered, was to enlist in the Union Army, which he promptly did, only to fall ill with dysentery and receive a medical discharge. After working his way back and forth across the Atlantic as a sailor, in 1864 he enlisted in the Union Navy. His fine handwriting got him a post as a ship's clerk on the frigate Minnesota. When the ship bombarded a Confederate fort in North Carolina, Stanley became one of the few people to see combat on both sides of the Civil War. The Minnesota returned to port in early 1865, and the restless Stanley deserted. Now the pace of his movements accelerates. It is as if he has no more patience for confining regulated institutions like the workhouse, a merchant ship, or the military. He goes first to St. Louis, signs on as a freelance contributor to a local newspaper, and sends back a series of florid dispatches from ever farther west, Denver, Salt Lake City, San Francisco. He writes disapprovingly of debauchery and dissipation and the whirlpool of sin of the western frontier towns. After an adventure-seeking trip to Turkey, Stanley returned to the American West, and his career as a newspaper man took off. For most of 1867, he covered the Indian Wars, sending dispatches not only to St. Louis, but to East Coast papers as well. It did not matter that the long, hopeless struggle of the Southern Plains Indians against the invaders of their land was almost at an end, that the expedition Stanley accompanied saw little combat, or that most of the year was devoted to peace negotiations. Stanley's editors wanted war reporting about dramatic battles, and this he gave them. The Indian War has at last been fairly inaugurated. The Indians, true to their promises, true to their bloody instincts, to their savage hatred of the white race, to the lessons instilled in their bosoms by their progenitors, are on the warpath. These dispatches caught the eye of James Gordon Bennett, Jr., the flamboyant, hard-driving publisher of the New York Herald. He hired Stanley to cover an exotic little war that promised to sell many newspapers, a punitive expedition the British government was organizing against the Emperor of Abyssinia. At Suez, on his way to the war, Stanley bribed the chief telegraph clerk to make sure that when correspondence reports arrived from the front, his would be the first cabled home. His foresight paid off, and his glowing account of how the British won the war's only significant battle was the first to reach the world. In a grand stroke of luck, the Trans-Mediterranean telegraph cable broke just after Stanley's stories were sent off. The dispatches of his exasperated rivals and even the British Army's official reports had to travel part of the way to Europe by ship. In a Cairo hotel in June 1868, Stanley savored his scoop and the news that he had been named a permanent roving foreign correspondent for the Herald. He was 27 years old. Now based in London, Stanley could hear around him the first rumblings of what would before long become known as the Scramble for Africa. In a Europe confidently entering the industrial age, brimming with the sense of power given it by the railroad and the ocean-going steamship, there now arose a new type of hero, the African explorer. To those who had lived in Africa for millennia, of course, there was nothing to discover. We were here all the time, as a future African statesman would put it. But to 19th-century Europeans, celebrating an explorer for discovering some new corner of Africa was, psychologically, a prelude to feeling that the continent was theirs for the taking. In a Europe ever more tightly knit by the telegraph, the lecture circuit, and widely circulating daily newspapers, African explorers became some of the first international celebrity figures, their fame crossing national boundaries like that of today's champion athletes and movie stars. From Africa's east coast, the Englishmen Richard Burton and John Speke made a bold journey to the interior to find Lake Tanganyika, the longest freshwater lake in the world, and Lake Victoria, the continent's largest body of water, and capped their adventure with a spectacle the public always enjoys from celebrities, a bitter public falling out. From Africa's west coast, the Frenchman Paul Bellamy du Chaillu brought back the skins and skeletons of gorillas and told riveted audiences how the great hairy beasts abducted women to their jungle lairs for purposes too vile to be spoken of. Underlying much of Europe's excitement was the hope that Africa would be a source of raw materials to feed the Industrial Revolution, just as the search for raw materials, slaves, for the colonial plantation economy had driven most of Europe's earlier dealings with Africa. Expectations quickened dramatically after prospectors discovered diamonds in South Africa in 1867 and gold some two decades later. But Europeans liked to think of themselves as having higher motives. The British, in particular, fervently believed in bringing civilization and Christianity to the natives. They were curious about what lay in the continent's unknown interior, and they were filled with righteousness about combating slavery. Britain, of course, had only a dubious right to the high moral view of slavery. British ships had long dominated the slave trade, and only in 1838 had slavery's vestiges been abolished in the British Empire. But the English quickly forgot all this, just as they forgot that there had been slave revolts in the West Indies and that economic factors had hastened slavery's end by making it less profitable. In their opinion, slavery had come to an end throughout most of the world for one reason only— British virtue. When London's Albert Memorial was built in 1872, one of its statues showed a young black African, naked except for some leaves over his loins. The memorial's inaugural handbook explained that he was a representative of the uncivilized races listening to a European woman's teaching, and that the broken chains at his feet refer to the part taken by Great Britain in the emancipation of slaves. Significantly, most British and French anti-slavery fervour in the 1860s was directed not at Spain and Portugal, which allowed slavery in their colonies, or at Brazil, with its millions of slaves. Instead, righteous denunciations poured down on a distant, weak and safely non-white target, the so-called Arab slave traders raiding Africa from the east. In the slave markets of Zanzibar, traders sold their human booty to Arab plantation owners on the island itself, and to other buyers in Persia, Madagascar, and the various sultanates and principalities of the Arabian Peninsula. For Europeans, here was an ideal target for disapproval, one uncivilized race enslaving another. Arab was a misnomer. Afro-Arab would